It's the Sleep Well, Stay Well podcast. Here we go. With Malia Jacobson as your host.
Hello, and thank you for joining me for another episode of the Sleep Well, Stay Well podcast. I'm sleep and health journalist Malia Jacobson. I hope you're doing well and enjoying our new turn into spring and sunnier weather. At least it's sunnier where I live. I'm not sure how it is where you live. If you're like me, the last couple of months have been a time of some pretty hard lessons, some that have been good, some not so good, and some lessons that you really maybe didn't want to learn. I think one lesson that many of us are learning right now is just how sensitive our bodies are to light. Whether you're stuck at home working in front of a screen all day, whether you're helping kids with home-based schooling, whether you're busy all day and working late into the night to catch up, whether you're spending more time indoors, whether you're spending more time outdoors, many of us are dealing with changes in our daily routines, and those result in changes in the way that our body is being exposed to light. And even if you are too busy to notice, your body definitely notices. Light is a big regulator, one of the biggest ways that our body regulates our circadian rhythm and our sleep patterns. And so some of the things that you might notice, some of the things I'm noticing in myself and my kids are, you know, more difficulty winding down at night, more difficulty kind of turning off and going to sleep at the end of the day, in addition to just some eye strain and headaches from all that screen exposure. My kids have gone from pretty minimal screen exposure. Most of their schooling was face-to-face when they were in school. Now that school is closed, they are on screens just for hours a day. And we're trying to break that up with time outside as much as we can. But then there's also just changes in our commute and our daily routine that mean that we're not getting exposed to light, natural light, outdoor light, in the same way that we used to. Not as much light in the morning that we used to have with our morning commute. And so all of those things are just things that add up and end up having a pretty big impact on our sleep patterns, as well as our mental and physical health, as we'll talk about later. And I don't know if there's a better expert to address the impact of light on our mental and physical health than a psychiatrist who also happens to be a sleep specialist. Our expert, I'm very excited to welcome Dr. Alex Demetriou, MD. He is dual board certified in psychiatry and sleep medicine. He treats patients with a wide variety of mental health related issues such as anxiety, PTSD, depression, bipolar disorder, ADHD, and sleep disorders. He completed a fellowship in sleep medicine at Stanford University and received his medical degree in psychiatry at Stony Brook University. He's the founder of Menlo Park Psychiatry and Sleep Medicine in Menlo Park, California, where he applies a thorough knowledge of neuroscience and pharmacology to attain the most minimal, efficient, and holistic solutions possible. I'm very excited that he's taking the time to join us today. Let's get him on the line.
Dr. Demetriou, thank you for joining me today. I'm really happy to have you here.
Hi, Malia. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on your podcast.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for making time for this. I know you are busy right now. I think last time we chatted, you were in the middle of homeschooling. How is that going?
It's always a challenge because I think we're all trying to work and juggle, you know, two kids at home. It's certainly a lot to be doing. But right. But so far, so good. And I got to tell you, I'm really enjoying the quality time with the kids at home, too.
Yes, same here. And I certainly am also learning a lot about their learning styles and exactly what it is they are learning. I think we're all learning together as I get my review in dividing fractions and dynamic addition and subtraction and all those wonderful things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the few positive things of everything that's happened, I do see more families spending time together. And that's actually been a good thing, I think. And certainly the chance to be home with the kids has been nice.
Yes, I agree. So before we get to our main topic, which actually incorporates some of this learning that we are doing at home, how changes in our screen habits and environment are affecting our sleep, I wanted to talk a little bit about your approach to sleep medicine. As a psychiatrist and a sleep medicine specialist, you view problems, sleep problems rather, through a mental health lens. Can you talk about why this is important?
Absolutely. I mean, for me, I think, you know, the first thing I should say is that I think sleep is just so essential for the brain. It's the time for the brain to sort of sort out memories, to practice emotional situations. It plays a giant role in our brain, also cleaning itself up from all the activity of the day. So to me, you know, following sleep medicine, it felt like a natural progression for my interest in psychiatry, because to be honest, so many things are interrelated between how we function during the day and how well we sleep at night. And I compare sleep and psychiatry to sort of almost like a yin and yang, where there is truly this like interconnected system where the days can affect the nights and the nights can affect the days. And it truly, as a psychiatrist that also does sleep medicine, we've had some amazing outcomes by actually being able to help people sleep, as well as modifying, you know, symptoms during the day, such as anxiety, insomnia, anxiety, trouble focusing and concentrating, and optimizing that so people actually do sleep well at night.
Right. I think the last time we spoke, you said that looking at sleep disorders on their own without taking into account mental health is just looking at, you're looking at the night side of the picture without the day. So it's only half the puzzle.
Absolutely.
Was a great way of explaining it.
And the other half is true as well. I think, you know, looking at the day, looking at daytime symptoms without taking into account how the nights go is also a significant issue. So the two are truly related. And I think actually, you know, my hope is that more psychiatrists become aware of sleep medicine for the sake of improving patient outcomes, because we've seen some amazing outcomes by doing both.
Right. Yeah, I agree. So let's talk about some challenges that people may be facing with their sleep at the moment related to how much we are all using screens right now. But I wanted to talk first about more environmental changes in our environment and our habits and our daily routines. Many of us are having a lot of changes to our daily routines, like no longer having a morning commute or school drop-off if we are fortunate enough to be able to work from home. We are just getting up and going straight to our desks. Our kids are getting up and rolling straight into their schoolwork or screen time without that morning light exposure that we used to have just built into our daily routines. Can you talk about how morning light exposure in particular is important for our sleep health and our routines and some of the impacts that we might be seeing if we're just taking that out of our day?
Absolutely. I mean, the first and most important thing to realize is that sleep is really like a very rhythmic behavior. And sleep really does best when the rest of our lives are sort of like rhythmic and cyclical. In sleep medicine, we often talk about the circadian cycle, which is the cycle of activity during the day. And sleep really benefits from regularity of schedule. And I think, you know, with this recent coronavirus epidemic, we've really sort of like lost our rhythmicity. A lot of people that I work with are, you know, sleeping in later hours than they normally are. Their morning routines have been completely upended by things such as homeschooling, Zoom meetings, and other work and family interruptions that normally weren't there. The other thing I'm seeing also, in my practice, we call it home office syndrome, which is really a loss of the boundaries between work and play. And we usually see this in people that work from home, and now everybody's working from home, so we're seeing a lot more of that as well. And what we end up seeing there is that people lose the boundaries between, you know, the time that they spend working and relaxing, and the day sort of becomes a mishmash of never really having a prolonged stretch of work and also never having a prolonged stretch of relaxation. And for a lot of people, the loss of that structure also gets very stressful, and it can definitely impact sleep. You touched on a very good point, which is for a lot of people in the morning, there would normally be a commute. And even before the commute, there's a fixed wake-up time, a shower, and whatever the morning routine is, which is a pretty constant thing, I think, for most of us. And the drive home, the drive to work, you know, usually people are exposed to light. And light in the morning is particularly important in sort of telling our sleep system that the day has begun. We are especially sensitive to light in the few hours around the time that we wake up. Actually, we're more sensitive to light then than other times of the day. perhaps with the exception of the evenings. But really, it's the morning that sort of tells the body that the timer has started, the day has begun, and let's set the timer now for when bedtime is. And for a lot of people, not having that morning exposure to light can actually have impacts on insomnia and the sleep quality that they have during the night.
And so they might have more trouble falling to sleep at night, but maybe not make that connection that it is something that happened maybe 16 hours earlier in the day. That is,
Yeah, for sure. Usually what happens is the exposure to light in the morning tells the body that the day has started. And from there, once the day started, it's almost as if our bodies have a timer. And based on that timer, it'll say, you know, usually people sleep 8 hours a night. So that leaves 16 hours a night to sleep, 16 hours a day, rather, to be awake. So if you think about it, from the time you wake up, it's almost like a timer begins of about 16 hours. Depending on when that timer begins, 16 hours can get pushed much later. And I think people that don't get adequate light in the morning or activating activities such as eating breakfast, exercise, waking up and, you know, seeing the alarm clock and getting dressed, the loss of those things can sometimes result in insomnia later at night. And it's interesting, I think that the term for these signals in our day, it's called Zeitgebers. Zeitgebers, I think, is a German word, which basically tells us that this is like the clock is set at this point. And indeed, morning sunlight activity can sort of be that Zeitgeber that tells our body that the day has begun, start the timer.
Right, okay, thank you. And then continuing on through the day, I think people are just spending more time indoors in general and maybe getting outside for a walk if they can, but they don't have those natural built-in opportunities for activity that they would have walking to and from work from their car, walking to get coffee, walking around the block, walking their kids to and from school. We just don't have those natural built-in moments for activity and light exposure. So what are the impacts of just more time spent indoors overall?
I think more time spent indoors, you know, definitely limits how much exposure we get to natural light. And that is a pretty significant signal. I also think that, you know, like the problem when people spend too much time at home is we start getting boundaries blurred again. So there's less of a distinction between, okay, I'm home to relax and to sleep. And the mismatch between being home and working can kind of make it confusing for our bodies to tell when it's time to relax and when it's time to sleep, and versus when it's time to work. So because people are working more from home, indeed, I think a lot of us are more sedentary than we'd normally be. There might be a closer distance between the office, the home office, and the bedroom. And usually we definitely tell people never do any work in the bedroom, never be stressed in the bedroom. But certainly working from home does bring that stress closer to the bedroom. So in addition to the loss of light exposure and what I call vertical activity during the day, such as walking, running, walking to your car, going to get coffee, that gets lost and the boundaries get blurred, I think, as well between work and rest. And both of those, I think, can have significant impacts on our ability to fall asleep at night.
Right. Well, taking it more into the mental health sphere, could that home office syndrome that you mentioned be one of the drivers that we're seeing the increase in anxiety that we're seeing pop up for a lot of people because they're not getting that prolonged stretch of relaxation or because those boundaries are so blurred?
Absolutely. I think what I've seen in my practice, and this was happening a long time ago also, it's not something that's happening just now because we're all sheltering in place, but usually what we would notice is that, you know, people that their schedule is too loosey-goosey during the day, they actually end up stressed because they feel that they're never really resting, and they're also never really working for a prolonged stretch. So there's always this kind of like, you know, nagging feeling of I should be doing more work. And I haven't done enough. It's the feeling that a lot of us might have had in school when you had a project or a book report that was due in like 2 months and you feel like you should be doing it, but you're not doing it. And the reason that that happens is because there's almost too much freedom to be able to do it anytime you like. And what ends up in those situations, much the same as what happens now, is people aren't really getting a solid chunk of work done. And they're also not having a solid chunk of relaxation. And they end up neurotic and stressed that they're neither productive nor relaxing. And indeed, that can raise people's anxiety significantly, as you mentioned.
Right. And I think we may be even seeing that in kids where they have quite a bit of work assigned, at least my kids do, but they have complete freedom in terms of when they're doing their work. And most parents are not in a position where they're able to enforce a very strict schedule, or at least the same type of schedule that you'd see in school, where they have to start, you know, the bell rings at 8:05 or in whatever. At home, we have to be a little bit more flexible and responsive to other responsibilities and work and things like that. But I think the result is that there is this nagging anxiety that I'm seeing in a lot of kids, that's just, they're doing well, they're getting their work done, but they are feeling anxious about it. And, you know, I'm just kind of thinking maybe that's part of it. Maybe it's just they have that nagging feeling that there always is something else that they should be doing because they don't have that structure of that routine.
Absolutely. And I think beyond, so I think humans in general generally do better when there's a little bit of structure. Too much can be, you know, also excessive, but some structure always helps. You don't have to think very far to have an example of that, just to bring it back to school, where you realize that, you know, when you were assigned an essay assignment and told you could write about anything, for a lot of people, that's often a lot more stressful than when they're told to write about their last vacation. So certainly a little bit of guidance really helps reduce people's anxiety and give them direction, especially when it's something like work that we have to do. And that's definitely the case with children as well. Beyond the actual loss of structure during the day, I think we should also credit kids as well as ourselves for the actual just general change in our daily routine. This was a pretty big transition. Kids went from being in school for, you know, 6-7 hours a day to now being at home. And adults had the same experience with work. And I think that the transition alone can be a source of stress, in addition to that loss of structure that we're seeing as well.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And here in Washington, our schools are closed for the rest of the school year. And before that, they were closed initially for 6 weeks, and then the closure was extended through the school year. But I was almost glad when they were closed for the rest of the school year because of just the change involved in adjusting to a home-based schooling. And then as soon as everyone gets set with that, having the rug pulled out from them again and starting back in school for 4 weeks until the end of the school year, and just on this perpetual roller coaster of just change and change and change. And at least now that we know that school is out for the rest of the school year, we can all work on establishing those routines that are working for our families at home, instead of having it just changed every 4 to 5 weeks. That's just incredibly stressful.
Absolutely. I think, again, speaking to, you know, habit, people are creatures of habit, and we get into rhythms, and once we have a rhythm, we kind of tend to stick to it. And having flip-flopping rhythms is actually stressful for people. It even comes back to sleep, where people that work shifts, that don't work regular hours, experience a lot more insomnia, anxiety, depression. And there's even rumored to be some increased risk of cancer and illness in these people, simply because they're not in their regular rhythm and their rhythms are being flip-flopped constantly. We see that in shift workers and people that have to travel often and a lot and experience frequent jet lag. And I think also on a more macro level, even, you know, with the onset of the coronavirus epidemic, what I saw in my practice is that in the beginning, the first week or two, we really saw people suffering through that initial shock and fear of what this new thing is and the change in schedules, as well as what this could turn into. And what I've actually seen in the past, in the 2-3 weeks that followed, is there was almost like a stabilization. It felt like things had plateaued. Following that initial, you know, 2 week initial period of significant transition and stress, it looks like things have settled a little bit currently. It might be at a higher anxiety and stress level than it ever was before, but I think we're also over that initial hump, which was the transition time, which does, I think, add a lot of stress to people's lives.
Right. Yeah. Those transitions are stressful. So let's talk about the effect of some of the transitions that we are experiencing, or the changes. And for, I think, my family and many families, that is spending more time on screens. I know my children have gone from having mostly face-to-face interactions all day long to doing most of their schooling on screens. And I think many of us are dealing with something very similar in our work lives, where we used to have a lot of face-to-face interactions that are now taking place on screens. And then we go to our screens to decompress and for recreation and to check in on our loved ones. So can you talk about the impact of all that screen time and that blue light on our mental and physical health and our sleep patterns?
Absolutely. So to give you the quick answer, you know, screens, whether it's your phone, whether it's your iPad, your computer, smart tablet, you know, certainly emit blue light. Blue light during the day. So our eyes are trained, our brains are trained to feel that when they see a blue sky, it's time to be awake, right? The sky is usually blue, and therefore blue light really has this effect on our circadian sleep system that tells our bodies it's daytime, it's time to be awake. And certainly a lot of screens emit a lot of blue light. I should also mention that a lot of LEDs in people's homes, especially ones that have this like really high temperature rating, I think it's like 5,000 Kelvin, they always rate like how bright the blue light, the LED lights are. A lot of these lights also emit blue light. And blue light is a signal for our brains that basically says it's daytime, be awake. It's an alerting signal. We see the opposite with like red lights and yellow lights and the light of a candle, basically. And interestingly, those colors actually look like sunset colors. So the blue light that comes off of a lot of screens sends an alerting signal to the brain saying, hey, it's daytime, get up and be awake and be on. Screens during the day are less likely to impact our sleep, but screen use in the evening hours, anytime, let's say between 2 to 3 hours before the intended bedtime, can have the negative impact of causing insomnia by suppressing melatonin. Because basically the brain, you know, at 9 p.m. starts thinking that, hey, it's still bright out. And it's time to be awake. And a lot of people will say, hey, you know, my screen's not that bright and it's not so bad. And what I often tell the people that I work with is, you know, for a moment, if you're sitting in a dark room with your phone or your computer, aim it at the wall and ask yourself, does it work as a flashlight? And I think a lot of people very soon at that point realize like, wow, this thing I'm staring into is not only a blue screen, but it's also a pretty darn bright flashlight. And you realize that this is a point of light that's actually close to your face. And the intensity, as well as the blue light, can really have a negative impact on our ability to fall asleep.
And do you recommend any of the blue light blocking glasses or the products that are on the market now? I know I'm seeing people talk about those and recommend those on social media. People are experiencing eye strain or sleep problems and saying that these blue light blocking glasses could be a solution. Is that something that you recommend?
Yeah, absolutely. I think anything that can reduce blue light, whether it's amber colored glasses, I've had some of my patients actually use brown tinted polarized sunglasses. Anything that kind of cuts out the blue and adds any sort of a reddish yellowish tint is useful. I should also point out that there's apps that actually try to reduce the amount of blue light that comes off the screen. I haven't seen the data on that, but my understanding though is still that behind the screen that we're looking at, there is actually an LED light that's emitting blue light. So how much of that gets filtered through the pixels on the screen is questionable. And certainly the light can be made more red, but underneath it, there might still be an actual blue light source, which can have that negative impact on melatonin and worsen insomnia. Beyond the actual blue light coming off of the screen, what I also need to point out is even for people that use things like amber colored glasses to cut the blue light, we should also realize that a lot of technology is interactive. And just the fact that, it's you're scrolling, you're clicking, you're searching for text on the screen, that tends to send a bit of a dopamine signal to the brain. And the interactivity alone can be quite wake promoting. And thus can result in insomnia. The example I always give my patients is, you say you can be up till 3 a.m, you know, reading articles and blogs and news feeds, but try reading a book and see how long you can stay up. And the reality is most people would say after 15 minutes, they're dropping the book and they're asleep. And I think that has to do with the blue light as well as the interactivity of the experience.
Right. And probably depends on the book you choose to. For sure. Now, I know that I've heard some recommendations and some sleep specialists say that looking at your laptop, looking at your social media feeds or your phone late at night when you can't sleep or within the last hour before bed is too activating, both because of the blue light and because of the dopamine that you mentioned that comes from the interactivity. But what about watching TV? I have heard some specialists say, well, okay, if you have to watch TV, if reading a book isn't an option or that's not going to do it for you, at least the TV is further from your face and it's not interactive. So it's not going to have quite the impact. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably not as bad as using a phone or something totally interactive. The big criticism of television ever since it blew up in people's homes in the 60s and 70s is that, and kids, by the way, were watching a lot of TV back then. TV is really passive, right? TV really is no interactivity. And you asked the question earlier about kids having screen time. I just want to take this chance to say that there's a difference between passively watching, you know, media versus interacting. And in that regard, it could be that computers and smartphones might be a little bit better than the classic image we had of televisions in the 1970s and 80s. But getting back to your question about television at night, the textbook answer is technically no, because they, you know, everything that cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia teaches is that the bed is really for sleep and sex. There should not be eating, working, TV watching, music listening, iPhonings, you know, smartphoning, or any of that other activity in bed. TVs, while not ideal, are probably still better than having a smartphone, you know, close to your face, or even worse, having a laptop where you're trying to work in the bedroom. But so the strict answer is ideally no. Perhaps an even better option than watching TV may be like having an audiobook play in the background and not have the blue light also coming from that. There's apps now, Calm is one of them, that also have like, you know, bedtime stories and calming scripts and relaxation routines. Audio is technically still better than video if you're trying to fall asleep at night. But yeah, I mean, TVs versus laptops or smartphones are probably still better, but I would say audiobooks and reading probably are better yet.
Got it, thank you. Now, in at least where I live in the Pacific Northwest, we are headed into a season right now where we're just being flooded with light a few minutes more every day. And by June, we will be having a sunset close to 10 p.m. and we will be getting light before 5 a.m., so maybe 4:30. So there's just light almost around the clock. We're just flooded with it. I wanted to ask, as a psychiatrist, are there people who are particularly susceptible to the sleep disturbances that would be brought on by too much light? Are there, I know some people maybe sleep like a rock all year round, don't have a problem with their sleep, and they're probably not the ones listening to this podcast. And then there's other people who seem to have to be more sensitive to disturbances in their sleep from light. So I just wanted to ask, are there people that you work with who have a particularly tough time at this time of year when we're just flooded with light?
Well, for sure. You know, I mean, the quick answer to that is that in my practice, people with depression, people with bipolar disorder can usually have a significant mood shift around the time of daylight change. What's interesting is at least people that are bipolar are more likely to experience mania or like complete, you know, loss of sleep and heightened energy and impulsivity and grandiosity that happens in the spring, and the opposite that happens in the fall when the days start getting shorter, or later in the winter months when the days are really short. Another way to look at this is, you know, it depends on how thick or thin somebody's sleep is to begin with. There's people that are just not great sleepers. Truly, this population does tend to have some level of anxiety. And let me just point out that anxiety is not all bad. You need a certain amount of anxiety to prepare for things, you know, to plan ahead and to get things done. But there are people that have a lot of anxiety. People with anxiety tend to not sleep so deeply. They tend to, you know, awaken often during the night or easily, and it might take them a little longer to wake up and a little longer to fall asleep, and they might wake up a little too early in the night. So in my practice, I usually refer to that kind of sleep. There's people that are thin sleepers. In other words, they're easily disturbed. And truly, for those people, when there's this rapid change in daylight hours, as well as reaching a point where there's a lot of daylight hours, yeah, the natural signals can make it hard to fall asleep.
Thank you for explaining that. And I think as we have, I think incorporating all the things that we've talked about, we're just dealing with a lot in terms of trying to maintain our daily rhythms, our sleep health, and our daily routines. What are some things that you recommend that people can do to, especially when it comes to managing their screen exposure and their exposure to light?
So I think it's healthy. It's important to note that there's two important times when natural signals and light really matter. And that tends to be in the morning and the evening. In the morning hours, I think daylight is actually important. It's good to get that natural light upon waking, as well as the physical activity. Ideally, you know, food also has some impact in telling our bodies when the day has begun. The other half of this is what happens in the evenings. Because in the evenings, daylight, screen time, exercise can all be things that can actually make people be more awake. So we often recommend that, you know, people don't use screens in the 2 hours before bed, that people don't exercise in the 2 hours before they plan to sleep, ideally even longer. And certainly, you know, you want to have this like clear distinction, I think, between work time and relaxing time, and let the evening start winding down and not work right until basically, you know, 1 hour before bedtime.
Right. So going back to the home office syndrome that you mentioned earlier, what are some key takeaways that people can apply to stop that from happening?
There was a song that had the lyric, I think, you got to keep them separated.
Right.
but I think what it really comes down to, that's basically it. You know what I mean? I think people really benefit from, and by the way, kids benefit from this also, which is having an agenda for the day. Saying that from, you know, you wake up at 8:30, you wake up at 8, by 9 o'clock, you know, you're having breakfast or you start work. And then you have a chunk of time that you're actually devoting to doing one thing, trying to shut off external distractions, maybe finding a quiet corner in the house where you can work without the interruptions, but we know that's hard. But at least really in your own mind, setting this sort of like routine and schedule where you have chunks of time where you have certain expectations. It's almost the same example as like having that distant project. It's better to break it up into pieces and say, you know, these 4 days I'm going to work on this piece. And on a more micro level, as we talk about home office syndrome, it comes back to basically saying the first 3 hours I'm going to work on this. Then I take a break, I get lunch, I go for a run, and then I return to work. But work then also ends at 6 or 5 p.m. And there's really a clear wind down. There's time with the family, there's time to cook, and there's time to maybe get outside also and get some fresh air. And then basically wind down time from, you know, 8 p.m. onwards.
Right. Yeah. And as someone who I've worked from home for 11, 12 years now, so I'm constantly learning things that I could be doing better or ways that I can change my routine. But one thing that I find really helps me is just actually the act of physically closing my laptop every night and not leaving all those tabs open, not leaving all those documents open to come back to the next day or just in case I have a moment later in the evening, but just actually physically shutting down my laptop. And it's amazing how simple that is, but how easy it is also to skip it. And it just, the cue that just kind of tells my brain work is done. I'm leaving my office for the night and I can restart tomorrow. But just small things like that, I think, can go by the wayside when we're busy or stressed.
And this kind of comes back also to like the dopamine surge that people get from electronic devices. Because what happens is your same work laptop, you know, you could end up like, you know, surfing the internet, reading some news stories. And again, there you see the blurring of like work and play, and you end up with your laptop open while you're watching TV, thinking you're working a little bit, but also reading some news stories. And it's that mishmash that really stresses people out. So I think you really hit the nail on the head where it's like, you know, you want to shut the laptop down and transition to the other part of your day.
Right. Well, thank you. And I know when it comes to, you know, managing our sleep and our health, we're just all juggling a lot right now. So if there's just one thing that you could get people to do in this area, what would that be?
I think the most important thing really would probably come down to having a fixed wake-up time. You know, we often tell patients that, you know, it's hard to control when you fall asleep, but you can really control when you wake up. And because you realize that sleep really benefits from rhythmicity and regularity, it's usually very beneficial to people to keep to a pretty regular wake-up time. sure, you can sleep in a little bit on the weekends, but it shouldn't vary by more than like an hour. The pattern of waking up at, you know, 7 a.m. on weekdays and sleeping in until 11 on weekends is really not good for sleep. And with less of a difference, I think even now we realize it really helps sleep if you can keep it at regular hours. And the most control you really have is in the morning and setting a wake up time that's fixed each day.
Yes, it is. That it is so important. And it's amazing how everything just kind of falls into place after that. At least totally. I have found that's been advice that I've heard for over a decade interviewing many, many sleep doctors. And it was very hard for me to implement it in my own life. And when I finally did, I was so glad. It does make a huge, huge difference and really is one of those things that it's like a domino. All the other dominoes just fall after that without a whole lot of effort.
Absolutely. Yes. And I think it was Matthew Walker in his book, Why We Sleep, that I picked up the term, you know, create an opportunity for sleep also. It's like create a window for sleep, which basically alludes to the importance of in the evening, besides just having a fixed time to wake up in the morning, you know, staying up and exercising or playing on your laptop right till the last minute of the night doesn't really create that window, the chance for your body to fall asleep either. So I think it's really important to also allow to the creation of this quote unquote window of sleep, which is an 8-hour stretch of time at least, where there is no activity, there is nothing exciting, and you actually really open that possibility for sleep to occur. That in combination with a regular morning wake up time does a lot of good for people's sleep patterns and quality.
Okay, well, thank you so much. That's very helpful. I really appreciate your time here and sharing your expertise with us. Where can people learn more about you?
So my website is siliconpsych.com. You can look us up on the web, Menlo Park Psychiatry and Sleep Medicine. And we're always open to inquiries and always we consult people sometimes as well that just need a brief consultation or guidance on either psychiatry as well as sleep issues.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. Appreciate that.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
There you have it. Thanks for listening all the way to the end of the interview, and I really hope it was beneficial for you. You know, this time of year, we're just going into May, we're going into our season of longer days and late sunsets here in the Pacific Northwest where I live. And I always have such mixed feelings about it. It is such a wonderful season. You can get so much done. We can go for walks after dinner. There's so much daylight to enjoy. And yet I'm always tired because the extra light just wreaks havoc on my sleep patterns. And what I'm hoping is with Dr. Demetrio's advice and just being more intentional about keeping track of my daily habits and routines, that I can greet this new season with a little bit more joy and a little less exhaustion. I did contribute to a Washington Post article on this topic. It was last summer, and I was interviewed while my family was on a trip. So we were on vacation, and I was doing a phone interview as my kids were running around a hotel room. So it was crazy, but the article is pretty interesting, and it is about having mixed feelings about those longer days of summer and the impact of all of that extra light and the changes in our daily routines. So I will post a link to that article in the show notes because that's pretty interesting. And if you're like me, you love the longer days, but you don't always love the super, super late sunsets, you might find it interesting. I hope that this podcast has been helpful to you, particularly today's episode with a psychiatrist who's also a sleep medicine specialist. That is like two experts for the price of one, no appointment required. And I am working hard to bring you the best experts that I can find. And so I hope you can take time to rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcast or whatever podcast player you use. That would be wonderful and really mean a lot to me. You can also keep up with the podcast on social media, on Twitter at SWSW Podcast, on Facebook and Instagram at Sleep Well, Stay Well. And you can reach me at Malia@sleepwellstaywell.com. Our next episode will focus a little bit more on pediatrics with a very well-known pediatrician who I am very excited to speak to. And so all you parents out there, this next episode is going to be for you, and it'll be a good one. Until then, please sleep well and stay well. Bye-bye.
It's the Sleep Well, Stay Well podcast, now you know. Thanks for checking out the show.